enthusiasts, and welcome to Style Points. I'm John Crow. On this episode, we're talking to my friend and colleague, Dr. Yusuf Razlan. Let's just jump right in. This was, it was kind of emotional for me going through all this past stuff.
Yeah.
As it brought back a whole lot of memories. I'm sure when I sent you the questions and you were reading through it, it probably brought back a lot of stuff for you too.
Yeah. So I guess I know that we've talked about it before, but it's always good to get perspective from someone else that was closely involved. Because I mean, I obviously know my perspective, my family, my wife, but, sure. I don't know. I don't really have a lot of opportunities to sit and like talk openly about other people and kind of their outlook on it and how they saw how that like kind of what they felt and their emotions that were happening through something like that. I don't know. It's kind of selfishly, I've just been so worried about myself from that perspective and just like healing mentally.
Sure.
I think I'm pretty much like, I don't know. It's a thing of the past at this point. And there's a lot of lessons I took from it, and I'm definitely different from before that versus now, but
can't imagine how you wouldn't be.
I know. Yeah. So, I mean, every once in a while there's like, just like residual, like just days where I don't know if I'm particularly thinking about it, but like, it's kind of hard to describe it. You just, I guess.
Well, we can yeah. Pick up. I can
yeah.
Start going over some of this stuff.
Sure.
Actually start, you know.
No, yeah, it's good. Now I'm warmed up.
Yeah, good. Today's episode is particularly meaningful for me as I have the privilege of sitting down with Dr. Yusuf Razlan, who's a pediatric anesthesiologist at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Yusuf isn't just a former resident of mine, he's my friend and somebody whose journey changed my life too. In March of 2022, Yusuf experienced a sudden cardiac arrest while playing basketball and was admitted to UC Hospital. Yusuf, I'm really honored to have you here.
It means a lot. I'm happy to be here.
So let's back up quite a bit.
Sure.
You are my resident. Halfway into residency, I found out that you had a cardiac condition that I didn't really know that much about. You were born with transposition of the great vessels. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So before that, I'll even go back even further.
Excellent.
When I was a fourth year medical student, I always bring this story up because John Crow had a bigger part in my coming to this residency program than he knows. Because oh, no. I did a what do they call it when you come back?
Like a second look.
Cause at the time I wasn't able to rotate. It was before COVID. So I could still do a rotation and like, I don't know, do those things. But I did a second look cause I liked the program in my interview, and I was with a resident that day, and it was John's first year as an attending.
Oh, wow.
And he was super nice to me, and he was really nice to Zach Sazonsky, who was the resident that he was working with at the time. And it was just good vibes. So, yeah, I don't even remember your question.
You were born with transposition of the great vessels. What was that like for you growing up? How did that affect your life?
Yeah. So growing up, I was born with L transposition. And I won't go into the details of that, but basically, I was born in congestive heart failure, and they typically try to wait to repair these procedures or to repair these conditions when there's like a survivable shunt. So I had a VSD at the time, so I was mixing appropriately from an oxygenation standpoint. So they let me grow for about 18 months, and they were continuously medically optimizing me. Until I got to the point where I was on a really high digoxin load and I was on Lasix as an 18-month-old baby. And then my parents and the doctors decided it was time to have a corrective surgery. I had an ascending Rastelli procedure where basically my right side of the heart functions as my left and vice versa. So, growing up, I went to the cardiologist every 6 months, had a ton of imaging done all the time just to make sure that my gradients were good between my neovalves and my ventricles weren't getting overly thickened, and making sure that I wasn't having any shunting in any inappropriate direction, making sure I didn't have any leaks or anything like that. And then when I was 14, I had a conduit. So when I was a baby, I had a conduit placed, an RV to PA conduit placed. It became really stenosed. So when I was 14, I got that conduit replaced. And I did it back at the original institution that did my surgery back in Boston. I did it at Boston Children's. Mm-hmm. That bought me another, I don't know, that was 2007 all the way till 2019. And then I started getting stenosis again, but this time they came a long way with like catheterization procedures and stuff, mm-hmm. like that. Had a stent placed through that conduit, and they placed a valve to prevent more backflow. And it really, that procedure alone totally changed my life. My exercise tolerance went way up, and things were great. So in 2019, when I had that procedure, that I remember I submitted my rank list for residency, and the next day I had that procedure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then I matched, and then I did 2.5 years of residency. And then, yeah, like John said, I was I never had any sort of conduction issues. I always had some ectopic beats, and I would go into arrhythmias that was noted on like things like I would wear heart monitors sometimes within those 6 month appointments. I never really had anything that needed to be treated. I'm one of very few people that have my procedure with the specific correction. So, for lack of a better term, I'm kind of a guinea pig that's like walking around. I know there's me and some other person out there that have very similar trajectories.
Weren't you one of the first people to have that type of repair?
So it's a Japanese repair. So the Japanese came up with this specific repair for my congenital issue. And I was one of the first few people in this country to actually have it done for my L transposition that I have. Like I said, I'm kind of like a walking guinea pig with this, and never had any conduction abnormalities or anything like that, other than the occasional ectopic beats, maybe a couple of runs of some ventricular arrhythmias that I could feel, and I would know that, okay, maybe I should take it easy. Nothing that really prompted any of my cardiologists to really pursue. They always brought up the idea of maybe getting a pacemaker or a defibrillator at some point, but I never really expressed the symptoms that concerned them.
For people who don't know Yusuf that might be listening, Yusuf, for all intents and purposes, looks like a normal, maybe above average in terms of the looks department guy that you would never suspect has anything like this going on. He's well-developed, plenty of muscle mass. He plays sports, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of remarkable. And when I found out that you had that very serious heart condition sometime during residency, I was really pretty surprised. Mm-hmm. And you just sort of seem to shrug it off when you would talk about it.
Try not to let it define me. I know it sounds kind of cliche, but I don't know. There have been situations in my life where it has been a halting point. Like, for example, like when I was in middle school, I couldn't play basketball because like the basketball team, the workouts required, I couldn't keep, basically anytime I just can't keep up. So from a cardiovascular standpoint, I'm a little bit more limited in terms of endurance. So anytime that really comes up, but honestly, my parents and my family has done such a good job of like helping me pivot from those situations. And honestly, that's what I feel like, that's why I'm here. Like, it's directed me to the friend groups that I have, and it's directed me to like being surrounded by people that like have boosted me up from an academic standpoint. So everything happens for a reason. And this condition hasn't really defined me. It hadn't defined me until the last 2 or 3 years. It actually, and when I say it defines me now, I don't mean it negatively. I mean, it's just like a, I don't know, it was kind of like a reality check of like, you have this and you have to respect it a lot more than I was previously. So yeah, I appreciate the compliment.
So you grew up with a medical parent, is that right?
Yeah, my dad is a cardiac anesthesiologist.
Do you think that that made a difference in terms of how you were raised or how he projected the future for you? Or
yeah.
Do you think that that's what made you trend towards anesthesia? What's your thought about all that?
If I told you that my dad was a first generation guy from Syria, that's a doctor, used to be a surgeon, came here, changed his career trajectory, just as a foreign medical grad, he went through that whole process and that's where he ended up. You would think that I was like pressured or like was expected of these things, but my parents are wonderful people and they never expected anything of me. So I would say that I was influenced by my parents in the sense that like my dad is an amazing person, and watching him work as hard as he did growing up, having a sick kid like me during his residency and still going through and doing what I need, getting through his training while providing me with what I need as a child with a congenital anomaly, while also raising my two brothers as well. Seeing him, sometimes he was late, but he was at all of our games. He was always home for dinner. We would visit him at work and he was always like awake and happy for us to be there. So for all the reasons that you wouldn't expect, I think that that is more of their influence as a medical parent, but never from an expectation standpoint. Like they just motivated me to be the best I could be. And I don't know. I just like succeed. My success comes from just wanting to make them proud. So
having met your dad at a couple of different occasions, I think worst and best scenarios.
Yeah.
Both when you were in the ICU sedated after your illness or during your illness. And then also later at your wedding, I really got to see him in a couple different scenarios. And I would agree with you. I think that he's a remarkable guy.
Yeah.
Very inspiring.
He's very grounded. He's very respectful of his surroundings. So to skip ahead a little bit, when I was really sick in the ICU, my dad is a very smart guy. My dad did his cardiac fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic. He's been working at the VA in Cleveland doing cardiac anesthesia for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it's like to be a parent as a doctor of a really sick kid, but I'm sure that I'm sure you have opinions when things are not particularly going well and you want to know information. But this is even something my wife mentioned, that he was just so grounded and so respectful, and he really just left it up to them to do what's best for me. So that just doesn't surprise me at all when I heard that from him. He's a religious guy. We're Muslim, and he's very much like a believer in like God knows, God's got whatever happens, God's got it. So I think that's a big foundation to that. But yeah, he's like a wonderful man.
Yeah,
for sure.
Having met him, I was very impressed with his demeanor and how he seemed to have everything totally under control, calm the whole time.
Yeah.
So I would echo what you have to say. Let's go to March 27th.
Sure.
What do you remember of that day? Do you remember that day at all?
So the day of my arrest, I do remember March 27th because the day of my arrest was the 28th. Mm-hmm. And the reason I remember that is because it's my mom's birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that funny? But yeah, March 27th, at the time I was a CA2, which means I was in my third year of residency, second to last year of training before I get my anesthesia certification. I was rotating at Cincinnati Children's, which is something that we all do as residents to get our pediatric numbers.
You had, in fact, just asked me for a letter of recommendation for pediatric anesthesia fellowship.
So yeah, it didn't take me long in my rotation there to know that this is what I want to do. And yeah, I had started like going through the motions of like putting an application together and getting things organized. But so are we going into like the story of like that day and what I remember?
Tell me what happened.
Yeah. So obviously some of it is a little bit gray. The 27th was just a normal day. I was working. I was sick. I had a cold. Turns out I actually had the flu. Didn't really think much of it. I wasn't super symptomatic or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Started feeling better on the 28th. Went to work, had a normal day, very busy day. I only know that from looking through old texts of like texting my attending, like, hey, we're going to pick up. It was like one of those ENT days where you do like 10 cases and
gotcha.
You're just doing high turnover. I don't remember any of it. But I remember I was feeling better. And like John said, I'm a pretty fit guy. I like to be active at least 3 or 4 times a week. And at the time I was playing a lot of basketball at the UC Rec Center. And I told my wife, like, I'm feeling better. I've been kind of cagey at home. I think it was a Monday. And I decided, like, I'm just going to go try it out. I'm going to go play some basketball at the rec center. So got off work around 4:30, called my wife. We FaceTimed while I was walking into the gym. And then from what I'm told, I only lasted about 5 minutes before I told one of the undergrads that I didn't feel good. Like something's wrong. Like I could feel something was wrong, whether that be I was like nauseous or if I was feeling like palpitations that wouldn't stop. I don't know. I don't know what I was feeling, but basically the look on my face scared this kid to the point where he like stopped the game, booked it to the lifeguard station, and told them that something was really wrong. And then basically it was just like a code red. Like everybody's coming, I guess technically it's a code blue, but everyone's running to the court. Everything's stopped. At that point, I've arrested. I'm in a shockable rhythm. I'm pulseless. They do 10 minutes. So lucky for me, it was like 5:30 shift change. So there was a million lifeguards there. All of their staff and managers were there. So they were running a full code situation. Called an ambulance. I needed 10 minutes of chest compressions, and I was shocked multiple times before EMS arrived. I think by the time EMS arrived, I was my heart was beating again. I was mm-hmm. back. But I don't know anything after that. I don't know what my mental status was like. I don't know if I was intubated. I don't know what was going on. I just know that they packed me in the ambulance and took me about a mile and a half down the road back to work at UC. And it's so crazy now, cause I think about, I have such a vivid image of it because I mean, this is where I worked, right? So I know exactly what it's like. They put me in the shrew, and they did the assessment, stripped me naked, I'm sure. They weren't sure about my neurologic exam. Because I don't know if I was showing anything or whatever, but they put me down and tubed me, put a breathing tube in.
I actually do remember a little bit about this. You were apparently fighting a lot at the time, yeah. And that's why they intubated you.
Okay.
It's because you're in a, of course, you wouldn't have any memory of this, but you were kind of swinging.
Yeah. So one of my friends in the ER, now that you mention it, I do remember that her, she was the one who intubated me. One of my good friends.
Oh, wow.
She like, I texted her like months later cause I'd heard that she was there. And we worked as interns together. Like when you're working in the ER as an intern, you spend a lot of time with them and you become friends with some of them. And she was so happy. She shot me a text and well, I texted her actually to thank her. And then we talked for a while, but she told me what happened. That's kind of how I have this, image, but yeah, so from there I went to the cardiac ICU, intubated. When I was fighting and when I was coding, I vomited and I aspirated, so mm-hmm. I had a pretty significant aspiration pneumonia, to the point where it wasn't getting better after about 4 or 5 days. Mm-hmm. I wasn't oxygenating. I was ventilating, not oxygenating. And I was requiring like ARDS treatment. Like I was paralyzed. They had to prone me for several days,
right?
Just to prevent me from having to go on ECMO. And then, as soon as like the ECMO conversation started happening, that's when I turned a corner about a week after I was in the ICU. But yeah, I got better and eventually progressed to like them weaning my sedation and I remember them weaning my sedation and talking to me. We can talk a little bit about like what I remember from all of this, from like being in the ICU specifically, because that's a whole story in itself.
Sure.
But yeah, I got tube out on April 5th, and then I was discharged directly from the ICU on April 7th, so which is my birthday, funny enough. But
I don't remember that.
Yeah. Wow. So one of the toxic things about being in medicine and being a patient is that you know exactly what you need to do to get the hell out of the ICU. So I knew that's the ICU we rotate in. So I know the ICU checklist. So I knew that I had to go to the bathroom. I had to walk around, work with physical therapy, occupational therapy, basically show that I'm like no longer sedated. My mental status is good. Right. I'm able to function. I knew that I needed like some sort of device placed, and it wasn't going to get done at UC. So I knew I needed the life vest. Mm-hmm. So I like really like pushed on getting, cause I just wanted to get out of there. I was so like people were coming into my room, like all out of love, cause people were happy I was doing better. But, all these nurses that I know are like working. I mean, it's all in good faith, but it's uncomfortable. Like to be in a room, I know exactly what room I'm in, and I know exactly the team that's like rounding on me, and I was just ready to go. So I got discharged with a life vest like 2 days after I got extubated.
Tell me what a life vest is.
So a life vest is kind of a bridge therapy, or it's like a destination therapy for people who need a defibrillator of some sort. So if you're somebody who's not a candidate for like an ICD or an internal cardiac defibrillator, mm-hmm. some people will just wear a life vest forever. Or if you're me, and you know you're going to get a defibrillator, but at a later date because you need to like work out the kinks. For me, the kinks were that I needed to get it done at Children's because of my anatomy. It's very complex, and they know it better than they do here. So I took this vest home, and I had it for about a day and a half until my dad called me, and he just said, "I really don't feel good about you just like being home with this vest.
Sure.
That may or may not work." So I'm like, what happened was we coordinated, and I just like went and got directly admitted to Children's in the cardiology department.
Right.
And I just sat there for 2 weeks, got a diagnostic cath with the electrophysiology folks there. And then once they tried to like figure out where this arrhythmia came from, but they really couldn't figure it out, which is kind of like unsettling for me.
Sure.
But they were able to reproduce it. And they were able to shock me out of it in the cath lab, which kind of shows that like, okay, that means that like this defibrillator that I have now can probably help me if this comes up again.
Right.
More than likely, I should say. And then it has the pacer function too. So yeah, I've had it for about almost 3 years now. So yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I will tell you the story of how I learned what happened to you. Mm-hmm. Is I came in to work that next morning, mm-hmm. and Mark Cassidy came up to me and he said, "Hey, did you hear Yusuf had a code?" And I was like, "Oh, all right." It's like, what happened to the patient?
Yeah.
Because I thought he was just telling me that one of my residents had run a code, or that something mm-hmm. had happened, which happens from time to time to the anesthesia residents, you know, they will run codes from time to time. I had no concept to that whole conversation that it was actually you who had coded.
Yeah.
And then he told me that. I was like, oh, I guess I'll just check in with Yusuf later and make sure he's doing all right. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think much more of it. And then as more and more people started saying, "Hey, did you hear what happened to Yusuf?" I was like, whoa, what are we talking about here? And then it wasn't until later that I found out that it was actually you.
Yeah.
I have the email from Friedrich that he sent out on 328.
Mm-hmm. I haven't even seen this email before.
Dear colleagues, as most of you are probably aware by now, a resident member of our UC anesthesiology family, Dr. Yusuf Raslan, was admitted to the UC CVICU last evening after suffering a cardiac arrest while playing basketball and undergoing ACLS in the out-of-hospital setting. Mm. What's not mentioned, by the way, as a brief pause in this email, is that ACLS in the out-of-hospital setting has a approximately 10% survival mm-hmm. rate. Back to the email. Doctors Wojciechowski, Bailey, Justice, Satoris, and Howarczyk have been in contact with Yusuf's parents, and while they allowed this medical information to be shared with the department, I would implore all of you to please respect Yusuf's privacy in the days ahead. For now, please rest assured that our friend and colleague is in the best possible hands, and we will keep you updated as the situation progresses and as his parents permit. There were actually a lot of emails that went out saying, do not go to the CVICU. They had people that were specifically watching and trying to make sure to give you the maximum amount of privacy. And the resident who was up in the CVICU at the time, that was a tough assignment.
Yeah.
Because they really knew more about what was going on with your care, but because of HIPAA and everything else, couldn't share it.
Was it Connor?
It was.
Yeah, I remember. We talked a lot about it. Because I have access to my notes.
Right.
Like, I have my chart. So I saw there was a couple days or in a couple, well, he was on nights, a few of the nights that I was there. And he would write, like, progress notes because it's his assignment. Like, I'm their patient. So, yeah. I really empathize with him on that.
There was another email that gave the program directors permission to provide daily updates, and they said that somebody will touch base with the daytime or nighttime intensivists each day to obtain information for an update and send out an email to the residents and faculty to streamline communication, because for a long period of time that is all anybody could talk about. And when people would say, hey, how are you doing, everybody knew that was in reference to, like, how are you processing this. Mm-hmm. I remember when the residents started finding out about this, everybody was still in the operating room, mm-hmm. and there was a concerted effort to get all of the residents out of all of the ORs. And it was actually amazing that we were able to relieve everyone very quickly, thanks to our CRNA colleagues who understood the gravity of the situation and were very helpful. But we got all of the residents out and, in the resident lounge, and we all just kind of sat there and tried to be a community together.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I mean, you guys made me, like, posters, and I still have all that stuff. I can't see. Yeah, that's it. He just pulled it up on his email.
Yeah,
I still have that. I can't like ever get rid of it, I don't think. My cats have kind of torn it up a little bit, but it's like, I don't know. I still have it, and I still, like, see it pretty much every day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You have it out?
I just have it, like, in my room. Like, it's up, it's behind a bookshelf,
mm-hmm.
but I can see it there, because I just can't get myself to get rid of it. I don't know why.
Yeah, I imagine so. I remember the residents making it and mm-hmm. putting stuff on it. I put a little gold star on it.
Yeah.
Like, when it was.
I know, yeah. I remember graduating from residency. And I don't remember who it was. It might have been Huestner. He was bragging about, like, how he had two gold stars. And, like, I was like, I have one. He's like, it's not on your badge. I was like, I know, but I have one. It's there somewhere. So, yeah.
Wow. I remember being really torn up about it. And the thing that we always shared a passion for was our basketball teams.
Yeah.
Having done my residency in Oklahoma City, I'm a big OKC Thunder fan. And Yusuf always has been a big Cavs fan.
Right.
And the way that I helped process some of my feelings about all of this is, normally every day I wear a OKC Thunder themed scrub cap, but I purchased and wore a Cleveland Cavaliers scrub cap
mm-hmm.
For a long time, telling myself that once you got better, I'd give you that hat.
I still wear it.
Do you really?
All the time. Especially this year, because we've been winning so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great time to wear it.
I still wear it. I think about you every time. It was very sentimental. and I appreciated it.
Wow.
Yeah, man. Next time I wear it, I'll wear it this week because we're still winning 15 in a row.
Yeah.
So I'll send you a picture. I still wear it every day for the most part.
Well, when our teams inevitably meet in the finals and you lose by just one game, it'll be very sad, but.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Yeah,
that's going to be great.
That's the ideal
matchup. I hope that happens.
Me too, actually. And part of why I'm secondarily a Cavs fan, although I'm primarily and will always be a Thunder fan, is purely because of you.
Yeah, totally.
Just being a fan of you made me more of a Cavs fan.
Thanks, man. So. Yeah, it's the same goes for Oklahoma City. Even though they were always likable, they're both small market teams that you can't help but root for, you know?
I agree. Yeah. It just speaks to good management. Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to turn this into a basketball podcast, although we certainly could.
Yeah, we could.
Probably talk for another hour about that. Let's talk about you being in the ICU. Let's go back to that time frame and what you remember.
Yeah.
So you were mentioning something earlier about how you were feeling and processing and some of the emotions that you felt. Tell me more about what you were remembering.
Yeah. So I guess one of my issues when I was in the ICU was that they were having a really hard time with sedation.
Right.
So I started having some propofol. I think it was like resembling of propofol infusion syndrome. So pee started turning green. My heart started getting a little sad. So then they started to have to switch to like other things, like more like opioid focused and like benzos and ketamine.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, my dreams when I was out, like I thought I was dead. I had the conscious thought of like this, like I was so comfortable. Like I was never uncomfortable. I was very relaxed. But my dreams were so weird that I just was convinced like I had the conscious thought of like, this is weird. Like I don't feel anything, but I'm like making thoughts and exactly. It's weird. But, it wasn't until they started like weaning some sedation. Once I started getting a little bit better, just to like assess my neuro status that, I can mostly compare it to like being underwater.
Really?
So like I can open my eyes a little bit, but it's just like as if you're opening your eyes underwater because they're putting like stuff in your eyes to keep to keep them moist and prevent you from getting like a
corneal abrasion
or like a, I'm trying to think of like opto terms, but like dryness and stuff like that. Just like the muffled hearing and like familiar voices, like my mom and my wife talking to me and Suzanne. I remember hearing Suzanne's voice and I was just like, what? This is just a weird dream. Like, but I'm comfortable because I know these voices and these are like my mom and my wife, like those are my comfort voices. You know what I mean? And then it was, that day, like April 4th, the day before I got extubated, I was still too weak because I was paralyzed for a while.
Right.
But they were able to wean my sedation. I didn't pass my RISB score, so they couldn't get the tube out, but I was able to like communicate and like say like to yes, no questions. I was trying to talk through my tube, couldn't. I was too weak to write, but I kind of had like a grasp, like I'm in a hospital. I'm surrounded, like my brothers are in this room. Like where the hell am I in Atlanta? Like, where am I? My brother, he was training in Atlanta at the time. And then my brother who lived in Seattle was there and I was like, this is weird. Like I'm dreaming. Then I kind of like Suzanne told me everything and it was still like a dream to me at that point. Like, oh, you're at UC, you had this happen, you were playing basketball. And like, I was like joking with everybody cause I didn't realize the gravity, like what had actually happened. Cause I'm still out of it. I can't really move. Like, I don't really understand. Like I have my brothers here. I have my buddy Ish, who is like an IM resident. Yeah. He was in there and another buddy of mine was there. John Kane was there. And it was just such a random group of people that I was like, what the hell is going on? And I remember it very vividly. And then, I guess they like increased my sedation for that night because I was out. And then the next day, I just remember one of the respiratory therapists pulled my tube, and I was just in a K hole for like 2 days, like a ketamine hole. I was having really, really bad, like once everything wore off and it was just the ketamine that was still there, some probably ketamine and benzos.
Mm-hmm.
I was having some really crazy dreams, like really crazy, visions. I was seeing things, I was hearing things, and that took like a day and a half. I didn't sleep a wink. Tortured my nurses, tortured my wife.
I'm sure.
But like they all knew that's not me. So like when I look back and I think about like, wow, how terrible I was to everybody, like they all know me. So, and I went back and thanked them all and gave them all big hugs. And, but yeah, then I got some clarity and then I was out of there. Like in a day I did everything. I was like, went to the bathroom, walked around, organized cardiac rehab at home, got my life vest, called the life vest people myself.
Really?
I swear. Yep, called them myself. The best part is that everyone thought I was in a K-hole the next day. I'd kind of shooken it for the most part.
Sure.
Called them myself. The lady showed up at like 6 a.m. Nobody knew that she came, but I did. I got fitted and everything. And they came and rounded on me that morning. And I was like, yeah, the life vest people came. And everyone's like,
they didn't believe you?
Oh, no. Yusuf's like seeing things. And I was like, no, it was like a nice blonde lady came and she fit it. And they're just like, that was probably your nurse. I was like, no, my nurse was a black lady. Like, it's not totally. And then the best is that they dropped a note in the chart. And then I think everybody realized like, okay, I think he's back to himself. And yeah.
Wow. I remember, I had the privilege of coming to visit you a few times. I was part of the effort with the Kudos Committee to,
mm-hmm.
collect. A lot of people really cared and wanted to send notes to you and to your family.
Yeah.
And we set up an email address that's normally just for people to send compliments,
yeah.
to each other, called the Kudos email. But we repurposed it so that people could send messages to you and your family. Mm-hmm. And we got hundreds of people who typed brief notes to you or sometimes longer notes. And I was fortunate to be able to come and deliver those, having gotten permission,
yeah.
To your family. And I remember giving those to you. And every time I went and saw you briefly and kind of got to tap you on the shoulder and told you I loved you, Alexander was always there.
She was
there. Every single time. I don't think she actually.
No, never left. Never left. So yeah, she was a resident at the time herself. And thankfully her program was super understanding, but she was here for 5 weeks.
Her program, which isn't in Ohio.
No, she trained in Florida. Just kind of went on a hiatus. They were super understanding. Thankfully she was a really good resident, and she always passed her exams, always did well, always like picked up for other people. So obviously people had no problem picking up for her.
Right.
And I mean, we're both so close with everyone there. We were anyway, back when she was training, they were all good friends of mine too. So it was hard for everybody. Not just like my family, but like all my friends here, all of her friends. She never left my side. We had gotten engaged like a year before that. And then we had like our Muslim wedding,
mm-hmm.
Maybe like 3 or 4 months before that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she was like pretty much my wife at that point.
Right.
From my perspective, we hadn't had like a big traditional wedding, but yeah.
Well, you did have a big traditional wedding
eventually,
later, which was a really great time, by the way.
That's one of
the best ones I've
had. Yeah, best day of my life.
So a lot of times people don't know what to say or how to respond to somebody after they've had a big traumatic event like, mm-hmm. you had. So what was helpful or maybe not helpful to you in your interactions with people afterwards? I know we talked about how it doesn't define you,
yeah.
but what advice would you give to people who are wanting to help in these sorts of scenarios?
Yeah. I think This is a good question because this is something I unpacked a lot in therapy. And I had to really like reel it back because one thing that I noted was that when people were trying to talk to me and like show their gratitude for me and just talk about it, which I don't have a problem talking about it.
Sure.
Everyone's trauma is different, you know? Everyone has bad things that happen to them in life and traumatic events, and like the severity is subjective, but I learned a lot about empathy through this. Just one thing that I've learned that I don't do anymore, just as a person, I don't try to compare someone else's trauma to my own. Like a lot of times people would tell me like stories that happened to them when they were trying to like empathize with me. And that's just like trauma that like I used to feel more sad after that, because like people don't realize you're trying to like have a common bridge with someone that you're trying to talk to, but all you're necessarily doing is just like offloading your trauma onto somebody else. And like, it took me a lot of time to, and a lot of guidance to just realize that it's all in good intention. Like people don't know, like, how do you talk to somebody who's died before? Like, that's how I, like, how do you like have that conversation, you know? So I think it was all just out of like people's genuity. But I would say like everyone's got their own issues and trauma that, it's just not, it wasn't healthy for me to hear other people's situational,
sure,
like situations, I guess. Just having people tell me like, I'm glad you're okay. That was like the most, when people like, I bumped into people in the hospital every freaking day for like 6 months, people that I didn't see their face. So like every time your first interaction is just like a big emotional, like, oh my God, I'm so like, you know, like you won't see somebody for like 6 months and then you see them and then you haven't thought about this day in so long. And then they just talk about it. Yeah. They just talk about it. And the best interactions that I had were just like brief that were like, I'm glad you're okay. So I don't know, anytime that I hear tragic news or somebody's going through something, I keep it brief and I just let them know that I'm thinking about them, and I don't try to belabor it unless they want to talk. Like I'm happy to talk anytime. I don't know, sometimes, especially if we weren't close before,
sure,
it was hard to have those conversations with people. But yeah.
So let's go less than a year after your event. It's
sure.
January, 2023. You're watching Monday Night Football.
Yeah.
Damar Hamlin collapses on the field. What's going through your mind? What are you thinking?
So, oh yeah. It was just like a bird's eye view of something. Like, it was very eerie for me. I mean, it was eerie for everybody, but for me specifically, like that moment, within 5 minutes, I got probably like 15 text messages from different people. Like, are you watching this game? My mom called me, my wife called me. And then I'm looking at it. And I knew, like, when they go to commercial like that and there's a big crowd of people, I was sitting with my roommate at the time and I just said, I think they're doing chest compressions on this young man. And lo and behold, like they get back, the tone of the game is super somber. People are crying on the field. And I just kind of knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. My mom called me crying. She's just like, this is what happened. This is like, I'm getting like really, my mom got really traumatized.
I imagine there's a big PTSD component.
So then for me, it was just like having a different perspective on the whole thing. Cause like for me, when I had my arrest, I was fine. I was asleep in the ICU. I don't remember anything. I just woke up. I had some rib pain cause I cracked some ribs, sure. But otherwise like I, it was all just emotional. And mostly just like supporting my family, and my wife emotionally. But now I'm like seeing it from the other end of like, this is really happening. And this person's mom is watching this, and if he's got a partner, she's watching this. And yeah, it was just a different perspective for sure.
So tell me a little bit more how you got involved with that situation afterwards.
Sure. So Damar was here at UC for about a week. I don't know, maybe less than a week. I kept my distance. I was like, you know, keeping tabs, but in the back of my mind, I knew like this guy got immediate CPR, which is the most important when you have an out of hospital cardiac arrest. The most important thing is witnessed and like very limited downtime before compressions start. So I knew that they were doing compressions. I knew they secured his airway. I knew that, I didn't know, I shouldn't say that, but like, I felt pretty confident. Like this guy's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he got here, and it was just so similar to me. It was so similar, like witnessed arrest, immediate compressions, got him here, got him settled in the ICU. They're doing all the things for him. So my view of it was like a little bit less morbid than everyone else, I think, because I just kind of had this feeling like, I think this guy's going to be okay. And you're seeing all the news cameras and people, and everything's like very sad for like days. It was like all the news, all the sports news, everything, all my notifications on my phone, Twitter, whatever.
Sure.
And I just had like a different perspective of it, of just like, I think this guy's going to be okay. And then you start hearing things around the hospital, you know, like he's doing better and things are going in the right direction and blah, blah, blah. And then, I think it was my mom. She made the nudge. My mom made this comment of like, you know, I didn't really have anybody at the hospital to kind of tell me everything was going to be okay. Like people told me that all the time, but like nobody credible, like, you know, like nobody like other than like, yeah, you have doctors and stuff like that, but nobody, sure. Nobody who's like gone through something as eerily similar within in a vicinity, like as being in the same city, in the same hospital, same similar situation. I mean, I have my congenital stuff and he's otherwise, from what I know, otherwise healthy, that just having this random thing. But we're both like young men that like this really was unexpected.
Right.
Doing things that we love to do. And like, it totally just changes your perspective of like, what do I do after this? Like, can I work? So, like immediately after I got out of the hospital, like the question of like, can I drive? Mm-hmm. That was huge. Like I couldn't drive for 6 months after my arrest, like from the date of my arrest. So like that was life altering, but like there was an end date to it. So like, but I didn't know that. So there was like a lot of depression leading up to like, I can't drive. Nobody's had this conversation with me. Can I be in an operating room by myself? Like, is that legal? Like, what does this mean? Am I done? I don't have disability insurance. I don't have this, that, like everything kind of just like clobbers you at once. And I think that, having somebody like myself to go and talk to my mom and tell her like, it's going to be okay. Like this. And I know that because this literally just happened to me. So I had to jump through some hoops to get there. Basically, I just broke all the rules and it just went because everyone told me no, because it was pretty much, it was pretty lock and key in the ICU. And I figured, you know what, this department will have my back. So I kind of ignored permission and I just went and I just walked into his room, when I knew it was appropriate and, just kind of went in my street clothes just so that I wouldn't give this illusion that like, I'm a doctor coming to update you or anything. I just wanted to go in there. I quickly like introduced myself and said, I'm here as a doctor here, but I'm also just here as a friend. And it was like 7 PM. So everything was chill. Mm-hmm. Nobody was rounding. Nobody was like doing anything. And I just sat in his room for like 15 minutes and we talked about it. His parents were there and they were really appreciative. And he asked me for my contact information just to talk. Cause like they were like, when I walked in that room, it was like deer in headlights. People don't realize like, yeah, this guy's a pro athlete, but he's a kid.
Right.
And, like every time someone comes in the room when you're in that situation is like, you don't know what they're going to tell you. So, we just became friends. And then I don't know, I got his number. I was like, he's never going to text me. It's fine. Like, I'm glad I was able to like get, like say something to him and hopefully I helped. Like I had something to, I felt like I had something to give that was productive and that was a little bit different from maybe what they've been experiencing this week. Mm-hmm. And it turns out I made a big difference for that guy and his family. They know me by name. He's mentioned me multiple times when it comes to his like recovery and stuff like that. We still chat every once in a while, just catch up, nothing crazy. But I feel like I made a good impact on somebody from like something terrible that happened to me. Mm-hmm. You don't really like have that outlook when you're going through it. So like when I was able to like help somebody that went through something so similar to myself, it like helped me too. Cause I was in a funk. Like at that time I had just started driving at that point.
Right.
But, I was like taking an Uber to work every day and I couldn't get groceries. I couldn't like go to the gym. I couldn't do anything. Cause it's like, I got to pay for this. And like, I don't want to deal with all that. And it's just like, you get into like a depression and
sure.
I don't know. Yeah. So, that was like an uplifting thing for me that kind of helped me get through the rest of my residency, honestly. Cause that was like the home stretch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow, and this I think was the craziest part of the whole thing, you still somehow graduated on time.
Yeah. I only missed about a month of work. Yeah. Maybe like 5 weeks, but I don't know. I was going nuts. I was at home. I was feeling okay. I was going on long walks. I wasn't really getting super winded.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that was like painful was like my incision from when they put the defibrillator in, but that was,
oh, wow.
That was like the only limiting factor. And I got back to work and I worked with, I think I was with Sajin for a week, one of my co-residents. And he's like, I don't know why I'm here. Like, you're good.
I talked to him a lot actually.
Yeah.
Just to check on how you were doing. And then I think I remember I worked with you one of those very mm-hmm. first days.
Yeah.
I gave you one of my quizzes.
Yeah.
That was when I knew you were neurologically intact. Yeah. That's when you aced one of my tougher quizzes.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. Okay. Well, I guess he's all set.
Yeah. I mean, they were good to me. I don't think I took a call shift. It was months. Like people right. were just, I didn't even ask for that. People were just like taking them. People were just looking out for me. And then I finally had to say like, I can work. Like I can work on a Saturday, guys. Like you don't have to, I can sleep at this hospital. It's fine. But yeah, it was like true. Like the community here was amazing, especially like just within the department. I mean, I knew like this was my family away from home. I'm not from here.
Right.
Like, so like this was my family before that event. And then it just got even more solidified for sure.
Well, at the end of these, I usually ask people what their style points of personal preference in the OR, that have helped them succeed through their careers are. And I want to ask you sort of the same question, but obviously with a little bit of a different flavor based on everything that you went through.
Sure.
What style points do you have to offer for us based on your whole experience?
Let's see how I can tie this. I think ultimately, I don't know. I think the thing that I preach and practice the most is just respect. And I think that having like such a grounding experience. And so it, like, I always tell people, the thing that happened to me that impacted me the most was the impact that this event had on just my perspective on life. Just like I went from like being a medical student to a resident, like I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to do this fellowship, I have to do this research, and I'm behind on this, that, the other. And then this happened to me. And then just like everything became a bird's eye view. Like the perspective totally changed. Like family first. Like I thought that everything was good with my family, but I realized I had gotten such tunnel vision, like being in residency and like just pursuing my goals and my relationship. And like, I just had no like, big picture ability. Mm-hmm. So what came with that was just like loving everybody around me and just having respect for everybody. And I just preach that in the OR. I'm so nice. I try to be. I'm being really facetious right now, but I try to be so nice to everybody that I work with. And like, as far as I know, my reputation with the people I work with at my job, like I only get good feedback because of just how respectful I am to like the nurse that's orienting in the room, the circulating nurse in the OR, the surgeons, the fellows, the medical students, just like I treat everybody exactly the same. Like there's no ego from the anesthesia side of things in the room that I work in. And it's just good vibes. And that's just like makes the day better for everybody. Even when you have like a really sick kid, if you're just like positive and you just wear it on your sleeve that like everything's going to be okay. And even if things aren't going great, if you just like try to get through it and don't get stressed and just know that everybody has a job and that they're doing their job to the best of their ability, without like upsetting people in the room. Those are my style points in the way that I practice. I've only been in attending for about 6 months, but I've just gotten a lot of feedback of when things are hitting the fan. Like Yusuf is like, has a finger on the pulse and knows like who to call. And that just comes from being calm and being respectful and not trying to do other people's job and trusting other people and just having that respect. And I like to think that I was like that before this event, but I definitely started being more mindful of it for sure.
From everything that I know and have talked to other people about, those are straight facts.
Yeah.
So I can confirm all of those things. I
appreciate it.
Thank you so much for joining us, and I really appreciate you coming here.
Yeah, man. It's an honor.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of Style Points. As a reminder, every episode is 100% organic, ethically sourced, farm to table, and free of artificial preservatives or additives, just like the Cleveland Cavaliers. It's my birthday this month. If you can't think of anything to get me, please consider leaving a 5-star review, or even better, a comment. That is what will help the mysterious algorithm find other people that might be interested in listening. As always, feel free to email me at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. Take a deep breath, open your eyes, we're all done.